and welcome to today's episode of the Religion Prof Podcast. I'm delighted to have as my guest this week, Derek Penwell, who is the pastor of Douglas Boulevard Christian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and the author of more than one book, and the new one is called Outlandish, with the subtitle An Unlikely Messiah, A Messy Ministry, and the Call to Mobilize. And in big block letters on the back, Jesus was a lousy Messiah. And so clearly Derek is someone who is quite happy to stir up some controversy, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. So Derek, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being part of this.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really honored to be here.
So how did you end up writing a book? You know, how did you decide that it was going to be called Outlandish? And you know, for people who might see, you know, Jesus was a lousy Messiah, you know, Jesus did everything wrong, might not read it. You know, let's jump right in and say, you know, what's your journey to write this book? But also, why should the people who bristle at what's on the cover read it?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, the title wound up being a kind of scaled back version of what I wanted it to be. My working title was Political Subversive, Why Jesus Was Such a Lousy Messiah. Mm. And my publisher said, you know, that might turn some people away. You put political in there and all that. And so Outlandish was an attempt to sort of temper that. And my thinking is that Jesus was so radical. I mean, if you stop and consider the kind of ministry he had and the kinds of people that he hung out with and that kind of thing, you begin to understand just how completely out there he must have appeared to people. And I wanted to capture some of this sort of outrageousness of Jesus as he must have appeared to people with whom he lived and worked. And so for our time, it struck me that we need that kind of a Jesus. With the current climate that we have in our country, with the division and with this kind of refortifying of privilege and power and so forth, we need somebody who is capable of bursting balloons. And Jesus was, I mean, he is that. If he's nothing else, he's really good at that.
Yeah. So I love the book and you found it really engaging. Of course, you know, one of the things that you share is that you're an INTP, and so am I. And you clearly like, you think Jesus was sarcastic and that we should be too, as you know, and following his example. And I like that. I'm a little bit worried that this may be reinforcing my worst tendencies when, in fact, you know, the message of the book overall is that we should be allowing Jesus to challenge us to live up to our best tendencies. But I'm really looking forward to, at the very least, talking about sort of sarcasm as possibly a spiritual gift, but at the very least, a thing that we can use in our arsenal for challenging injustice and as followers of Jesus. Whether we'll actually get to practice it on each other, we'll see. But I'm open to that as well, in case you're wondering. So when did you know you're going to write this book? I mean, did you have a sense, was there a particular moment when you said, okay, I know what my next book project's going to be? There's either this thing that's going on, or there's this thing I've come to realize about Jesus, or this thing I've encountered in my ministry. How does one end up writing a book such as this one?
Well, I mean, the real kind of watershed moment, it's not really a moment. It was that period of time that I think a number of people experienced following the presidential election in 2016, where it felt like one of my favorite podcasters, Merlin Mann, said, it's not that we misunderstood the game, baseball, but we understood that there was even a game at all. I mean, the whole world was completely different from what we imagined could be possible. I remember saying all along, there's no way, there are not enough angry white guys in the country to elect this man. And it turns out I was really wrong.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of, how do I deal with that? How do I be faithful in this context, knowing that the world's not what I thought, and that there's a lot more confrontation and division in it than I anticipated. And it began to dawn on me when I teach world religions. When I get to Christianity, I sort of introduce Jesus by what I tell my students are the unlikelies. Jesus was an unlikely teacher. He taught in unlikely ways. He hung out with unlikely people. All of these kinds of things is a way of suggesting that the Jesus that's actually in the Gospels was much different from the one that is sort of gilded in popular Christianity.
Mm. Yeah, and there's definitely, you know, something that I think a lot of people realize, although they may sometimes understand it in different ways, that Jesus is a profoundly countercultural figure in a lot of ways, you know, in relation to his own times, in relation to certain views of things like, you know, power, honor, ethnicity, things like that.
Yes.
And certainly one of the things that really struck me about the book, right, if you're an academic like myself, you know, sometimes when you see an attempt to state things in a way that makes it sound like it's happening in the modern day, there's, you may bristle or feel like, oh gosh, that doesn't, you know, that's not what that's not what I imagine ancient people sounding like. I know there's a point where you have a conversation where, you know, sort of the sons of Zebedee are like, sorry, pops. And I'm thinking, oh, I don't know. But then all this richness starts coming to the surface as the book continues, you know, and you're interacting with people ranging from, you know, Richard Horsley to James Cohn, you know, theologians and scholars and historians, and all these depths of riches of scholarship are sort of feeding into this attempt at popular and contemporary application of the message of Jesus. And it really is one of the challenging things, you know, to, on the one hand, figure out in what way somebody was countercultural if they lived in another time period, and then to figure out, okay, so what does that mean for us in terms of how we're potentially countercultural in our own time?
No, that's exactly right. Having worked in the academy and you know, done my share of academic writing, that I enjoy writing that way, but I also know that's not what most people are capable or even care about. Mm. So one of my goals in writing the book, or writing any of the books that I write, is to try to take scholarship, but to make it accessible. And part of the way I make it accessible is by making, you know, wisecracks and and so forth in the footnotes and in the text, and so that people don't feel intimidated by the book itself, that it's sort of like they're talking to a normal person. I realize that in doing that, I take a lot of liberties. I project back onto a culture that is not our own some of the assumptions and prejudices that we have that would not have occurred to them. And in that respect, it is not necessarily loyal to the history. But I do think that it is a way, and I think probably as a professor, as a teacher, you recognize that part of what we do is give people a place to hang on. Mm-hmm. with material and information that they don't have necessarily in their vocabulary. And so that's sort of my thinking about how I write.
Yeah. And I think we all recognize the need to do that, at least if we're aiming to get not just a purely abstract historical understanding, but a sense of the impact.
Yes.
Of something ancient, then there's really no way to avoid that. I mean, you can take something like the parable of the Good Samaritan, and you know, unless you find yourself in a context in which, let's say, there's, you know, anti-Muslim sentiment and it's predominantly Christian, then you tell a story about, you know, the pastor to the Sunday school teacher and the imam or something like that, then people might say, oh, how interesting, you know, and I'm glad I'm not like that, is of course our usual response to the ethical teaching of Jesus. You know, I'm not exactly like those people he was criticizing. And unless we update it to get something of that impact, then we don't really feel the message, right? We may have an abstract understanding, but, you know, we may miss the application entirely because we don't feel the impact the way ancient people did. And so there's always that tricky balance between trying to get the history right and trying to get the impact felt in our own time.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, helping people to imagine themselves in that situation, it seems to me ultimately is an important thing for lay readers in particular, or people who are not necessarily concerned with all of the historical work that needs to be done, but giving them some kind of emotional connection that is not, I would argue, not that far afield, and I hope I don't take too many liberties with Jesus, and that when I do, I hope people understand I'm being flip or whatever, but I'm trying to make a point. So, but I do think that being there in the moment with people is ultimately what helps them to find the courage to change. In order to be able to connect with them emotionally and have Jesus connect with them emotionally in the lives that they lead, that's a real gift. Not my gift. I mean a gift for to be able to engage with Jesus as he is.
Yeah, and I do think you have something of a gift. You certainly have a penchant for sarcasm that I approve of entirely and enjoy, and appreciated the wit in it. But I certainly think that, you know, whether it's, you know, someone who's tendency is to read books that are maybe very engaging and contemporary, but scant on historical information that is, you know, accurate and precise, or to read, you know, a lot of detailed historical treatments that maybe don't engage with, you know, contemporary relevance and help with that. You are certainly aiming to find that middle ground and keep both of those in the picture in a way that I think those who read one sort of book or the other ought to look at this one and see what happens when you put the two together.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, appreciate, you know, so many of the things that you say, and I don't think we'll have time to talk about all of them unless we decide, you know what, this was a great conversation, let's do another one sure. You know, in the near future. But definitely, you know, you talk about what love doesn't look like early on in the book, right? You get this example of these people who are being confrontational, are expressing, you know, sort of bigotry in the name of Jesus. But later in the book, you also talk about being confrontational in a way that's faithful to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so as one of the possible ways of getting people to realize, yeah, I need to read this book, how does one figure out the difference between those two? Because certainly the people you're criticizing early on and the people that I think you and I and many others who might gravitate towards this book are striving to be will say, well, we are, yeah, we need to criticize others and resist others in the, you know, in Jesus' name. And yet we're doing it from opposite sides of the aisle very often, and, you know, with very different assumptions. And so how do we figure out how to be confrontational in a way that's faithful to Jesus?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. It's one I struggle with a lot. In fact, that it's part of the it's part of how I think about sarcasm, frankly. And who we are confrontational with and how we approach that has to take into account power dynamics. And so, for example, when I'm sarcastic, and I'm, you know, I've sort of made a living on social media being a, you know, just a smart aleck. But I have real rules about that. It's not that I'm always perfect and live up to my own standards, but I have a rule about the fact that you never punch down, right? Or you never punch straight. And one of the things I say in the book is why sarcasm works in confronting power is that in so many other ways, people in power are kind of insulated because of money or positions. They just don't have to deal with people like us, like me. And sarcasm and irony and this sort of confrontation of power is a way of piercing that. And so it's not used in the service of, it can't be self-aggrandizing, and it can't be to belittle people who are already vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I take that. Now, this, as you say, may be just a really elaborate exercise in self-justification, but I try to sort of read the Gospels and see how Jesus deals with people. And it is almost universally the case that the people he reserves his greatest ire for, his worst sort of sharp-tongued criticisms of, are people who have power or who have wealth. He doesn't beat the sick and the outcast and the poor. He doesn't beat them over the head. He tends to be toward them loving and healing. It is the people with whom he has these sort of confrontations what I would argue are some of the only tools available to the powerless is sarcasm. I mean, think about the recent sort of issue over the State of the Union address, right? Mm. And the back and forth between the president and the Speaker of the House. And one of the things that people have been really sort of noting on a meta scale is that this president who has all of this power has never had to deal with someone who has the same kind of power, who wields power, and how disconcerting it is, because it makes you stop, sort of assuming, taking for granted that the world is the way it is because God wanted it that way, and start wondering, with maybe I am part of the problem. Mm.
Yeah, and I think that's really useful advice for anyone who's thinking about what kinds of jokes, what kind of humor, not just sarcasm but more broadly, are appropriate, and what makes certain kinds of things inappropriate. One would hope that people already understand these things, but for those who may be struggling with what's appropriate and what's not, what makes this case different from that, oftentimes it's the power dynamics, right, that yes. are the crucial aspect of it, which, that joke told by that person in that way, when they have the power and the butt of the humor, the sort of focus of the sarcasm, the focus of the joke, the mockery is on people who are already trampled on and marginalized and powerless, that's very different than if the people who have been trampled on, marginalized, and powerless are making fun of those in power. There's yes. just something fundamentally, essentially different about those two scenarios.
Well, think about comedy, right? And you have African-American comedians can make fun of, African-American foibles and so forth. But as soon as someone, who's white, if they were to participate in the same kind of, joke making, it sounds really awful. Mm. Because the power dynamics are shifted. And I think that that's really at the heart of much of how we need to read culture, is what are the power dynamics and how is it that we upset them, not for our own benefit, but for the benefit of those who are the most vulnerable.
Yeah, and probably a good New Testament example that sort of relates that is that, Jesus says some things, New Testament authors say some things that are critical of their contemporaries, and this is an inner Jewish conversation, right? But once Gentiles start reading these texts and repeating them and using the same rhetoric, it becomes something very, very different.
Yes, very much.
I think there's a real illustration there. So hoping that we're not just bolstering our penchant for sarcasm, what's a good example of Jesus being sarcastic, first of all, and then how might one you know, if one's like, okay, so I want to be sarcastic because I want to be like Jesus, what might that look like? You know, what's a good example of that for our time?
Well, I know. See, I think that's a good question. I think it's exactly the right question. Think about Matthew 23 and the Pharisaic woes. Mm-hmm. How Jesus just sort of lays waste to these Jewish leaders. And I mean, he calls them things like, you know, he calls his verbal opponents, rhetorical opponents, things like whited sepulchers and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. The kinds of things that when I'm accused of name calling of somebody in power, I say, well, you know, it's not, I'm not trying not to be any worse than Jesus was. I think that he provides an example of just how it is that we use this as a tool, because that's the thing. It's a tool, right? I mean, not unlike singing well or writing well or encouragement or whatever. Some people are gifted more than others. I think we can all agree on that just as a sort of casual observation. And so some people just can't, they just can't use it. They can't use sarcasm well, and probably should stay away from it because it just eludes them. But for those who can, I think it is a tool in the toolkit for people who are serious about confronting the power inequities in culture, because I continue to be convinced, as I've said before, that kind of irony and satire and so forth is sometimes the only tool that's capable of piercing an otherwise well-insulated life.
Yeah, and while sense of humor is, you know, famously one of those things that, you know, differs dramatically between cultures, you know, from culture mm-hmm. to culture and from time to time. And so it's one of the hardest things for somebody looking back, you know, from our time to a different language, different culture, different context to get a handle on. And I've seen lots of debates about, you know, what was humor like then? What was, you know, were they ever sarcastic? Was it the same as our sarcasm? Things like that. But mm-hmm. there are some very clear instances where Jesus is being, for want of a better word, comical yeah. in some way. And we can, I think, safely perceive that. I mean, another, you know, sort of up there, I'm not sure which I'd rank higher as far as a form of humor. You know, there's sarcasm, which is pretty high on my list. But then there's puns, you know. And, and of course, uh-huh. you don't have to choose between them. You know, you can be sarcastic right. and punny at the same time. Mm-hmm. But they're definitely, when Jesus is, you know, criticizing some of his opponents and says, you know, you strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. You know, it's, yes. I think, a wonderful example. There's a pun in Aramaic, right? You know, galma and gamla. Mm-hmm. But they actually did, you know, we have the, you know, the discussion, you know, in the application of the Jewish law about, you know, you live in a world where there are flies, there's, you know, there's no bug repellent or anything like that. And not a lot of, you know, not always a lot of fresh drinking water readily available to you wherever you are. And if you can't drink your drink because a fly got in it and the fly is unclean, the fly's died, there's corpse defilement and things like that, you're in serious trouble. And so they actually, I mean, this is a serious issue. This is not just somebody, you know, it's like, waiter, please bring me another drink, right? Right, I mean, that's exactly. You know, very different context. But, you know, straining out the gnat, right, the really tiny thing, and then swallowing the camel, there's a pun. And of course, a camel is an unclean animal. And so there's that element of it. And there's just so many layers of humor in that. I mean, there's pun, mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's critique of a whole approach to the law, and then there's the point that even people who don't know that can take away, even oftentimes reading in our time without the cultural background, that it's like you're getting the little thing but missing the big thing, you know.
And yes.
So humor, I mean, clearly Jesus, yeah. In fact, is it Amy Jill Levine who said that Jesus was, or maybe it was Bob Funk, I'm trying to think, but somebody said that Jesus may have been the first Jewish stand-up comedian or something like that. I'm trying to remember who it was who said that.
I don't remember.
But yeah, there's definitely an element of that, I think, in Jesus' teaching.
Well, and you know, I did a chapter on the parables, and which I argue, at least in part, is a form of subversive speech that gives Jesus some plausible deniability. And I think about, I sort of open the chapter with that really famous, now infamous, scene during the banquet. What do you call it? The reporters thing where Stephen Colbert, hosted, and he sort of lampooned George W. Bush, who was within 10 feet of him, sort of in a way that it was indirect, sort of his whole character, right? The Colbert Show character, which you're allowed to do, and is funny because you're doing it that way. It wouldn't be funny at all, and it would be really difficult to sit and listen to if you were sort of turn to him and say, look, you're acting like a jerk and blah, 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 blah. But because he uses a form that is somewhat indirect, it gives him a few layers removed from the kind of intense scrutiny that he might otherwise get. What I sort of have thought a lot about is the fact that Jesus uses tools that are really subversive. Mm. And in order to get his point across, he doesn't shy away from things that might be considered controversial. On the other hand, he also is sly about it, right? Mm. He doesn't just come out and sort of walk up and poke his finger in Pilate's chest. He's much more indirect about it, and I think that's a lesson we probably ought to pay attention to.
Yeah, so maybe that's a good point at which to segue into talking about Jesus, broader political vision, because of course, talking about him as Messiah, connect him with kingship, and traditionally, kings are expected to be the people who sit on thrones and are powerful, and so. You mentioned that, the inappropriate use of humor is, sort of punching down, from mm-hmm. a position of power, on one's, subjects or victims. And, how is Jesus different? Because, you do say that, Jesus did everything wrong, but you also say in one sense, he does everything right. And he's everything we need precisely by not conforming to that type. And so apart from sarcasm, I love talking about sarcasm, but, the broader message about who Jesus was and who Jesus is for people seeking to follow him today. How do we get from the sarcasm discussion that we've been enjoying so far to that broader point?
Well, I think a lot turns on how we define wrong. Mm. Because indeed, according to the kinds of standards for messiahship in his day, and in popular Christianity since, has often been that he act a certain way. And yet, when we read the Gospels, he often flies directly in the face of how a real Messiah is supposed to act. And my argument is that wrongness is actually a virtue, that it's good for us, good for the world, that he didn't fulfill expectations and does and continues not to fulfill expectations. He goes beyond them and gives us more than we could hope for.
Yeah. Thank you so much for putting it that way, because it's a really great way of doing it. There are so many details that I think are so interesting. And again, I just love the way that you sort of bridge the gap between the ancient and the modern. Even things that we might not think of, like, what was normal in terms of finding disciples, right, and calling mm-hmm. people, and that normally it was the students who sought out the teacher, not vice versa. And so, the fact that Jesus is calling people to follow him, what does that mean in that cultural context in terms of honor, in terms of who he is and the impression that he makes?
Yeah, I mean, in an honor-shame-based society, Jesus often puts himself at a disadvantage. And from that perspective, he's wrong if what your expectations are is that he's playing the game. He's opted out of the game, but that's good. And that's something that we ought to, that we ought to take a page from his book.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe since you said take a page from his book, I should, use that as a chance to mention your book again, even though we're talking about it all along. But I really do hope that people will read this book and will engage with it, because you really are just engaging with both the historical Jesus, questions not just of history and what does the evidence say, but also the socioeconomic context, but also our own context. Mm-hmm. And so who should read your book? Let's as we get to the end of our time together, let's make sure we're luring people into reading this. Who should pick up this book, and why should they do it? We know that the people with the penchant for sarcasm should, but they were on board already. But who else should be picking this up, and what do you hope they'll take away from it?
Well, I think people who want who feel a sense of urgency to get involved, to find some access point to advocacy and social justice activism. I hope what the book does for people like that is to give them a kind of theoretical understanding of why that's an important thing, given the life and the example of Jesus, but also to give them some practical tips about how to think about the work itself and working with groups outside of the church and in nonprofits and so forth who do advocacy work, because most people, that's kind of mystifying. It suffers from being opaque to most people, not unlike sort of publishing, right? People who haven't published or who don't know much about publishing, the whole thing just seems so odd and weird. I think that social justice work is much the same way. And I'm hoping to give people more of a sense that they are part of it, and that churches, the congregations themselves are ought to be communities of resistance.
Yeah. And there's so much in there, leading efforts for inclusivity and justice, not in spite of faith, as some of us, depending on our path, may have found in our experience, at least initially, but because of an expression of faith.
Yes.
And just for those who are looking for this sort of thing, there is even a little tidbit in there about how to get away with liberal theology in your church. And so we'll work that in as well, right? So there are all sorts of reasons for a wide range of people to be reading this. But if you're involved in Christian ministry, if you care about social justice, if you're interested in the historical Jesus, or you have a penchant for sarcasm, you should read this. If you do all of those, you should also be, following Derek on social media, and probably me as well, and be, and we should hang out and joke probably more than we have.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And one other thing that I would say what I would like to do is, in the book, is to give people who have this sort of socialized understanding that politics and religion are things that should stay in neutral corners, an opportunity to understand that that's not how the Gospels are written, nor should they be understood.
And I think the book does a good job of that. In one sense, you're not alone in saying, you're building on a wealth of scholarship that says that, on the one hand, Christianity today needs to be engaged in this way, and on the other hand, the historical Jesus was not an apolitical figure as he's sometimes depicted. Mm-hmm. But we don't always have the conversation having both ends, both of those poles sort of in the picture. And so thank you for writing this book. Thank you for not just making a throwaway comment that Jesus was a lousy Messiah, but explaining what you mean by that. And of course, there's something paradoxical about a crucified Messiah, right? From the
exactly
the get-go. And that's at the heart of what it means to be a Christian and what the Christian message is. And so in one sense, none of this ought to be surprising, and yet there's so much in there that really either is, even if it's not surprising, you give it a fresh spin and, you know, make sure the impact is felt in an interesting way and a creative way. And so really appreciated that about the book.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. I really, really appreciate your kindness in reading the book and being willing to talk to me about it.
Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Have enjoyed our conversation thoroughly. Hope that people who've listened will actually go out and read it. Will tell their local libraries to get it so that other people then just happen across it, as well as maybe getting a copy that way themselves. And yeah, look forward to other things that you're going to continue to write, both at length, as well as, you know, little snippets here and there on social media and in other places. But for today, we should probably bring this conversation to an end. So I'll say, thank you so much, Derek, for the book and for being here to talk with me about it today. And to everyone else out there, thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.